Thanks. Yeah, so I gotta sort of recalibrate myself to the audience. So I guess I'm gonna emphasize how maybe we should be worried a little bit about the presence of galaxies in our use of the Lyman Alpha Forest. There's been a lot of excitement about the fact that at last we have a simple physical system that involves baryons that where you can calculate things and simulate them and actually get something that looks like the real universe. And I'll talk today about to what extent that's true and to what extent you have to worry. And the bottom line is going to be that pardon me. Bottom line is that it turns out that galaxies in the intergalactic medium, and I'll be talking mostly about redshifts where the observations are easy, redshifts are around 3 or so. Galaxies in the intergalactic medium unfortunately coexist during about the most exciting time in the history of the universe since recombination, which is when more or less the peak of star and quasar formation was going on around redshifts of 2 or 3. And what this means is that you got to worry about all sorts of messy stuff happening at the same time that you've got this nice simple network of baryons that we think is tracing the dark matter accurately. And so I'll talk about what happens when you observe both of these, both the simple and the complex universes in the same volume, and try to see how they talk to one another. So that's the upshot of today's talk. So why are people interested in the diffuse intergalactic medium? There are lots of reasons. It contains 90% of the baryons, we think, roughly, at a redshift of 3 or so. There's some reason to believe that the physics is quite simple, certainly compared to what happens when you have to go into very overdense regions where you've had star formation and feedback and all sorts of messy things happening. It's very observationally accessible using extremely high-quality data of quasars behind the volumes that you're interested in. And you have access to extremely low gas and presumably dark matter overdensities using these probes, the quasars as probes. And then, of course, it's been found since about the mid-90s that the universe that can be evolved in a computer and the one that can be observed with quasar absorption lines appear to resemble each other in the ways that they've been tested so far. So this is really good. This is a, and of course the primary interest is finding an observable tracer of the dark matter. This is the main reason why people are interested in the Lyman Alpha Forest as a cosmological system. And the modern Lyman Alpha Forest paradigm is just that you have small dark matter potentials and you have baryons according to the baryon to dark matter universal ratio. And then you have some kind of isotropic radiation field that's ionizing most of those baryons, and you have a very small amount of residual neutral hydrogen. And the idea is that you can calculate exactly what you observe the neutral hydrogen, but you can calculate simply how much what is the total baryon density in that potential well, and by extension, what is the dark matter overdensity. So this introduced the so-called fluctuating Gunn-Peterson approximation, which says, well, let's treat this system of baryons that we think traces this filamentary dark matter structure as a sort of a simple fluid and a continuous medium where the density just varies along the line of sight. Now, if you're a theorist making a simulation, you make this picture first, which just shows a line through a simulation and just shows the log of the gas density as a function of velocity through your simulation cube. And you can see that there are all these fluctuations and that you have strong density enhancements and you have voids, just like you expect, and that the kinds of things that you expect to produce observable Lyman Alpha Forest clouds are all the things that peak up above about this level here. You can then easily make a prediction about how you would turn this gas density, given an ambient radiation, ultraviolet radiation field, into this plot that shows just the optical depth in the H1 Lyman alpha transition as a function of the same velocity through the system. And then, of course, you can make a simulated spectrum just by inverting that. And this is what you would see if you were to observe this same volume with a real background quasar and record it as the Lyman alpha forest. So, of course, just to remind you, each one of these lines is presumed to be H1 at a different redshift along the line of sight. So in essence, you get a map, a one-dimensional map of the H1, which you turn into a one-dimensional map of the dark matter fluctuations. So you get a bit more than that, though, when you do quasar absorption line studies. You get not only a one-dimensional map of the H1, I should say one more thing. One thing that's important is that about 70% of the mass contained along lines of sight is in these peaks that look like this, which turn into saturated Lyman alpha lines, where you basically have not very good information because the dynamic range is relatively small. So basically, the places where you can measure accurately what the fluctuation amplitudes are the same places that don't actually carry most of the baryonic mass. Yeah.
You said that you invert it and turn it into a map of the dark matter, and it's a map of the gas, and then you're assuming it's
right.
A ratio of the gas.
You're assuming, yes. That's the fundamental assumption, yeah.
But that last comment that you made, whenever you see a saturated feature, you have no idea how high it's going to go in the corresponding gas density when you try to turn it around.
Right.
So if you actually try to do this inversion and go from the bottom panel to the top,
Right. You'll be very uncertain in here. And there are various ways of dealing with that uncertainty, for some applications it doesn't matter at all. I'll talk about some of those, and some it matters a lot more. So not only do you get this H1 map, but you also get a map of where metals are, which presumably were produced by some generation of stars. We're not exactly sure a priori when those stars formed or when the gas was polluted with metals. But as far as we can tell, there are metals in the intergalactic medium at some level, wherever they've been looked for at significant, with any sensitivity at all. So you get this one-dimensional metals map and a one-dimensional H1 map. So what I'm going to talk about is what happens when you take into account, well, we know that sort of at the interstices of all of these filamentary structures that's mostly diffuse hydrogen are the knotty things that actually form galaxies, the larger overdensities. And here the idea is to let galaxies do their thing, and we know that galaxies are forming a lot of stars at these kinds of redshifts, and we also have some evidence that I'll talk about that they're actually messing up their environments fairly considerably. And so the question is, to what extent do galaxies perturb this diffuse intergalactic medium away from the simple physics that are nice to assume but possibly not true? So we're trying to observe the relative distribution of young galaxies and the IGM, and so we want to know, well, one thing you might be interested in is if the intergalactic medium actually traces dark matter fluctuations, then you ought to be able to measure fairly accurately what the bias of the galaxies is with respect to the dark matter, which is interesting for people interested in galaxy formation. So the IGM could be used as a tool to tell us what's going on with the galaxies if that were to work. But again, we're sort of looking for whatever's there. We don't have any preconceived notions about what we ought to find, except that you would kind of expect that places that have extra H1 are also places that have extra matter, and so they'd also be the most likely places for galaxies to form. So at some level, you expect galaxies and the intergalactic medium to be tracing the sort of same large-scale density fluctuations. I won't belabor these points for this audience, but it turns out that one of the big problems in understanding galaxy formation is understanding the baryon physics, which gets very complicated once the first stars form. And it's quite possibly the case that the biggest uncertainty is how to treat the feedback of energy produced by the star formation process into the system. And what happens after the stars form? You know, how do you keep track of what, how much gas there is at what temperature, and where does it go, how long does it take to cool, that kind of thing. And there's actually quite a bit of local evidence that feedback has been very important as a process in dictating what galaxies look like in the present-day universe. This is just a list of them. Things like fewer low-luminosity galaxies in the real universe compared to the prediction of most naive CDM-type models. We know that there are lots of metals in the intracluster medium. In fact, four or five times as much metals in the intracluster medium as there is in the galaxies themselves inside clusters. So the galaxy formation process has actually been rather inefficient. It's processed a lot of baryons through stars, but hasn't actually kept most of those baryons that it once had inside the galaxies. So that tells us that at some point that gas came out of the galaxies. We know that in the intracluster medium, when you go down to the sort of group level things, there's quite a bit of evidence now that there was some non-gravitational source of heating of the gas that had to have happened, and that's another piece of evidence for this kind of feedback. and of course, actually work that some of the work that Crystal Martin, who's here, has done is that we see evidence for that starburst galaxies in the local universe show substantial outflows, and in fact outflows at the level or even exceeding the level at which those same galaxies are forming stars. So they're getting rid of baryons as fast as faster than they're turning it into stars. At high redshift, I mentioned already that there are metals in the intergalactic medium. Obviously, that came from galaxies at one point or another. It's a bit funny, though. There are actually people who've gone around saying that they believe that the intergalactic medium, which is this very widespread medium, is uniformly enriched by some pre-galactic population of objects. And there's quite a bit, and people take that idea seriously. Which is a bit surprising, because I guess I would have thought naively that the first objects form in the same places that will eventually have lots, will be an overdensity later on, and so the metals are going to be made in the same places independent of what time they actually get formed. But there are ideas going around about uniform enrichment out there. And then, of course, I'll talk very briefly about very strong evidence for outflows in essentially every galaxy that we find. At high redshift, to the point that more or less everything out there behaves like a starburst galaxy blowing out a large fraction of its interstellar medium. I won't bore you with astronomical details. It's easy to find high redshift galaxies in sort of prescribed volumes now. There are ways to do it. It's fairly straightforward using combinations of 4-meter telescopes and the Keck telescopes to do the spectroscopy, so it's easy enough to select objects, then take them out to Hawaii and get redshifts and essentially make quasi three-dimensional maps of the galaxy distribution through within a volume that that you're interested in. Here, you can see that the redshift histogram, the selection function, more or less peaks at a redshift of 3. That's just an observational convenience, and now. And I'll tell you later about how we're using these to compare to the intergalactic medium. But the point is that it's now, what we can do is choose our cosmic epoch and find the galaxies there in whatever place in the sky we happen to need to do it. And this is just showing two different samples that we've put together over the last few years, one at around a redshift of 2 and one at around a redshift of 3. And this range between about 2 and 3.5 is pretty much the whole range of the high redshift universe where we have good dynamic range for looking at the H1. When you go to higher redshifts, you've probably all seen spectra of the redshift 6 Sloan Digital Sky Survey quasars that basically have no Lyman alpha forest because there's no flux at all. And if you go to lower redshifts, you need a big telescope in space, which we don't, that works in the ultraviolet. We don't have that. So this is observational convenience. I won't talk about that. This is just more stuff showing boring things like, well, you just choose your redshift and you can find galaxies. This is kind of a fun thing, but it's not very interesting to this particular audience, probably. So what do we know about the high redshift galaxies? I need to tell you a little bit about them so you understand why we think they might be important to what's going on with the intergalactic medium. Turns out they're very strongly clustered. They're as strongly clustered at redshift 3 as normal galaxies are in the present-day universe. And more or less that what that tells you is they are not the progenitors of average things in the current universe. They're the progenitors of things that would be much more strongly clustered than average objects. Because if you just let gravitational instability work over 85% of the age of the universe, it does some more since that time. And these have correlation lengths of about 4 megaparsecs. And you can actually read off the sort of number fluctuations in 10 megaparsec cubes just by looking at fluctuations in these bins, which each correspond to roughly 10 megaparsecs on the side. So effectively, you can read off sigma 8 in galaxies just by looking at these histograms. And they're quite strongly clustered, which was somewhat surprising at first, but completely expected with 2020 hindsight in the context of how galaxy formation works in a cold dark matter type universe. So what do you get for these galaxies? Well, in order for them to be so strongly clustered in the context of these models, they more or less have to be fairly massive. And the number that pops out for simultaneously reproducing the abundance and the clustering strength is roughly a few times 10 to the 11 solar masses. So these are fairly big galaxies, even though we're talking about high redshift. These objects have clustering properties which, if extrapolated to the present day, would have clustering properties similar to the kinds of galaxies that you find now in rich clusters and groups of galaxies. So their environments where these things are forming are not what you would call an average environment by the time we get to the present day universe. These are what the spectra, the far ultraviolet spectra of these galaxies look like, and I'm not going to tell you too much about them except to say we have all sorts of lines to measure that come from outflowing interstellar medium, as I'll talk about in a minute. We have lines that come from nebular emission, like this Lyman alpha line. There are stellar features from hot stars. And when you look at all of this together, it's unfortunate, though, that none of this actually lies at the true systemic redshift of the galaxy. And so you've got to figure out a way. It becomes important for what I'm going to say later to actually know what the redshift of the galaxy is. It turns out that that if you compare the redshift defined by the Lyman alpha emission line when it's present and the redshift defined by these very strong absorption lines from the interstellar medium, the average difference is over 600 kilometers per second. And that, you know, at redshift of 3 or so, that if you if you translate that into a distance uncertainty, it's more or less 6 megaparsecs or something. And that's not good enough for some of the things that we need to do. But what it does tell you immediately is that both the Lyman alpha emission and the interstellar absorption are basically coming, or the Lyman alpha photons that you see are scattering off the backside of the same outflow that it's producing, the interstellar absorption coming toward us. So the interstellar lines are blue shifted and the nebular emission from Lyman alpha is redshifted by roughly the same amount. And it implies that the typical wind speed coming out of these galaxies, and in some cases the entire source is covered by this outflowing stuff, so that you get lines that go all the way down to zero when you look at them at high enough spectral resolution. It more or less says that they're blowing things out at 600 kilometers per second.
Can I just ask Chuck?
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
There's mostly just O and B stars, so you have
yes.
to expect really high velocity signaling profiles.
Right, which you do see.
So
you see that too. Yeah. This is not quite the same. I mean, for example, this is carbon 4, and if you take away that emission line there, there's this big trough that's about 3,000 kilometers per second. That's from the actual stellar wind, the winds associated with individual stars.
So what I guess I'm wondering is how do you really end up being confident that you're differentiating velocities you're seeing from just some?
Well, I mean, these are low ionization transitions. They can't possibly be associated with the O and B stars. most of these very strong lines, like, for example, this one is oxygen 1. So it's, yeah, yeah.
It's not the star.
Right. Among other things, but that's the main thing. okay, so this is just another view showing you that that if you look at the interstellar, if you go to the near infrared, which is the rest frame optical, and you measure the kinds of lines that we use for galaxies today to measure redshifts, you get something that's closer to the systemic redshift. And if you then look at everything relative to that, you see that the Lyman-Alpha emission falls out here, and the interstellar absorption falls down here. And, you know, the characteristic velocities are in the hundreds of kilometers per second. I'm not going to say too much more about these galaxies. Just an interesting aside, which may or may not be interesting to you, but it's the newest thing that I have to say today. It turns out that when you do this kind of thing, when you look at galaxies at redshift 2 that are found in similar ways, more or less by their far ultraviolet emission from young stars, it turns out that there are well-developed rotational systems by redshifts of 2 and a bit. And this is really the first time that we've had real kinematic information on galaxies at these redshifts, and they're not terribly off scale on the low side compared to galaxies today. And this turns out to be fairly easy to do, which came as a surprise to us. So we might know quite a bit more about dynamical masses of high redshift galaxies in the very near future. occasionally, one of these galaxies, which is quite faint, sort of really stretching the boundaries of even 10-meter class telescopes just to get the redshifts, occasionally one is gravitationally lensed. This particular one would be one of typical luminosity, but just happens to get boosted by a factor of 40, and so we get a lot more spectral information. And all sorts of stuff that you can discover from this, from chemical abundances to kinematics. But what I wanted to emphasize is just a better view of how fast things are really moving around in these things. The green is the stellar redshift from actual lines in the photospheres of the stars in the system. And these absorption features from all sorts of different transitions of different ions go all the way out to about 750 kilometers per second or so. So, and then if you look at what, it's only got a little tiny little Lyman-Alpha emission line, but if you look at the kinematics relative to the stars, it's also redshifted by 700-800 kilometers per second. So that's what we think is going on, but seen in much better detail than we have for a typical object. So here's the picture. You've got lots of stars forming, typical star formation rates maybe 100 solar masses per year, which is very large by today's standards. Presumably driving out material at 500 or 600 kilometers per second. If they're anything like local superwind galaxies, the mass loss rate is higher, even higher than the star formation rate. So you're putting metal-enriched material out into the intergalactic medium. And you're also heating up these relatively large volumes of gas to temperatures well above 1,000,000 degrees. Well, how large do you expect these cavities to be? Well, the expected sphere of influence, if you have wind speeds that exceed the escape velocity of the dark matter halo, which things of 500 or 600 kilometers per second don't have too much trouble doing at these redshifts. If you do that, then you expect the sphere of influence in proper coordinates to be about 100 kiloparsecs times the age of the star formation episode. I put in here a typical number that comes out of the analysis of the spectra of these things, times the wind speed in units of 400 kilometers per second. So we're talking about 100 to 200 kiloparsecs proper. So that's a megaparsec co-moving, roughly. I won't talk about quasars unless someone wants to hear about that later. again, this is mostly astronomical things that I will skip over for the time being. One of the things we can do is try to measure masses of the galaxies, which is interesting because we kind of like to know, well, what are the sorts of things that are really perturbing the environment? And we already thought we were able to say indirectly that the halo masses were a few times 10 to the 11 solar masses. We can also infer how much stellar mass is formed in the star formation episode that we're seeing. And the numbers that we get are typically a couple times 10 to the 10 solar masses. And that's a good fraction of the baryonic content of one of these halos. It's sort of 30 or 40% of the baryons. That would be in a halo of size, 5 or 6 times 10 to the 11 solar masses. So these are incredibly efficient at turning gas into stars, but at the same time, they're blowing out a good fraction of the baryons. So you could imagine that if you carry this forward, you could easily deplete all of the baryons that you haven't. You could go through the entire inventory of baryons in a fairly short time scale, have a lot of stars and no gas left over. And that's more or less what we think happens when bulges in elliptical galaxies form.
So the 10 to the 11 solar masses,
that is within a virial radius, roughly, I guess. I mean, it's, within 50 to 100 kiloparsecs at these redshifts. So.
And that's the total mass.
That's the total mass.
We're inferring
the stellar mass.
So to determine the total number of baryons, the fraction of the baryons that are in stars, you're inferring some baryon to dark matter ratio.
Sure. Yeah. I took the liberty of assuming that it's roughly a sixth or so of the total mass is baryonic, something like that. Actually, if you were interested in what the history of one of these galaxies looks like, it would be something like this. Some chaotic thing happens, like a merger. You have a very elevated star formation rate for a short period of time during which everything is very dusty. And you've probably heard about objects that you can detect only in the far infrared and submillimeter, and one expects that it's this phase where you see them primarily in the far infrared because they're too dusty to let much of the UV radiation out. But these winds, they blow the gas and dust out at high speeds, and after a little bit of time you start opening up holes that allow you to see them much more easily in the far ultraviolet than in the far infrared. And you get, but when you integrate over this curve here, you get a few times 10 to the 10 solar masses of stars, and you have a sort of period over which you can see them using the techniques that we're using that lasts for most of that. So this is what we think is happening with these galaxies at high redshift. We think their chemistry is such that their chemical abundances are in the neighborhood of a half solar abundances, just in case anyone was interested in that. And we also see evidence for rapid enrichment on very short timescales. We get up to half solar metallicity. And the way that we know the timescales are short is because we see abundance anomalies that have to do with the kinds of supernovae that could have contributed to the enrichment in those elements. And more or less, we see the same kind of depletion that's seen in metal poor stars in our galaxy.
Let me ask a
question. Yeah, sure.
There are some elliptical galaxies that are metal rich relative to the solar phase.
Right.
And so where are those in this context?
Yeah, so I don't know. I wouldn't ever go out on a limb in saying that we're seeing ellipticals forming, because I think the average thing that we're seeing is probably a bulge. And ellipticals are the kinds of ellipticals that have supersolar metallicity are really big ones. And, here's one. This is at a redshift of 1.4. It's had a bit more time to accrete crud from the intergalactic medium and form more stars. But this is one where we've caught it at a redshift of 1.4, and it's not easy to do these observations at these kinds of redshifts for practical reasons. But this one is one that looks like it's probably supersolar. And this is extremely bright. But you would never recognize it as an elliptical galaxy if you looked at it at redshift 1.4. But it's almost certainly going to be one when everything settles down. This is a solar metallicity model of the far ultraviolet spectrum, which gets everything just about right, except some, the things that it doesn't get right require the metallicities to be a little bit higher. So they're out there. But I don't think you have many solar metallicity objects at redshifts of 3. I mean, it's still a hierarchical universe, and things are not finished forever with forming stars.
Well, just that the ages, I mean, you see populations which are old.
Right.
10 years old.
Right.
But with super solar metallicity, so...
Well,
it
I mean...
It has to happen.
Yeah, by a redshift of 1.5 or so. Yeah, I agree. Summarizing what we know about the galaxies. Strongly clustered, they're quite common. They're not really rare things. They have high star formation rates. In fact, their star formation rates are individually are much higher than you see at any redshift since that time. Things were really quite violent in terms of the star formation in individual galaxies at these redshifts. The winds seem to be everywhere. The typical time over which stars are being formed and where you're getting energy injection into the local intergalactic medium is a few hundred million years by inference. I won't talk about this today, but a few percent show evidence for AGN activity. And when you actually fold together various this time scale together with this 3%, it suggests that the lifetime of the AGN phase is around 10 to the 7th years, in case anyone's interested with that, in that. Fairly chemically enriched. Stellar masses are about what you would have for an L-star galaxy bulge today. And I won't talk about that today, but we have reason to suspect that a lot of the UV radiation field that we know is there at high redshift, which actually keeps the intergalactic medium ionized, is being produced by galaxies and not by quasars. So, this brings me to what I really want to talk about as newer things, which is trying to compare the IGM, the intergalactic medium, with the galaxy distribution and see what we can learn. So this is just typical quasar spectra. Yes?
Before you move on, you summarize what we know about redshift 3.
Right.
Very high star formation rate.
Yes.
But on a time scale that's relatively fast.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens at redshift 2? Or one
yeah,
and a half?
That's a very good question. I mean, it looks like we don't know much about redshift 2 yet. We've just started collecting data there. It's actually harder to work at redshift 2 than it is at redshift 3 for purely practical reasons that have to do with what wavelengths do we have accessible from the ground. And at redshifts 1, it looks like things that are still forming stars at a rapid rate are a completely different set of objects than the kinds of things that are forming stars rapidly at redshifts of 3. In other words, the things that are we see forming stars at high redshift, they're already done by a redshift of 1, and it's other smaller things that have picked up the pace at lower redshifts. It's all very qualitative right now, but it'll be quantitative soon enough. So what we've done, it's a fairly simple idea. We know how to find the galaxies, and we know how to find them in arbitrary places, so we choose those places to be volumes in front of background quasars. So we get the intergalactic medium map along the line of sight, and then we get the galaxy maps surrounding that line of sight. And this just shows the redshift sensitivity, where the galaxies that we find are in yellow. The sensitivity to the Lyman alpha absorption line is shown in the hatched magenta, and then the sensitivity to the metals traced by the carbon 4 transition is in green. So you can see that we're basically looking at volumes between about 2.7 and 3.4 that happen to lie in front of background quasars. So this is just another view of the basic idea. This is about 10 by 20 minutes of arc on the sky, which corresponds very closely to 10 by 20 co-moving megaparsecs for your favorite cosmology. and here is a very famous quasar called 1422 plus 23. It's one of the ones that has appeared in about 50 different papers on the Lyman alpha forest because such good spectra have been obtained of it. All these black dots are objects that were flagged by their photometric properties to be galaxies that lie in this volume of interest right in front of the quasar. The ones with green circles are ones that were where we attempted and succeeded to get a spectroscopic redshift for the galaxy. And this is what the distribution of galaxy redshifts looks like. Just collapsed into one dimension.
Does that include the photometric redshifts?
No, that's just the spectroscopic ones. We can't really use photometric redshifts for this. The redshifts aren't accurate enough. So this is what you sort of expect theoretically. So here's a fake universe. The things that are circles are halos that have masses on the order of a few times 10 to the 11 or greater. And you can see that they're strongly biased with respect to the underlying dark matter distribution. That's why we see the strong clustering in the galaxies. They're very biased with respect to the dark matter distribution. And to first order, what you expect is that when you take a skewer through a volume, if it goes through a rich environment, you should see more H1 absorption, because we expect that the amount of H1 traces the amount of dark matter. And when you go through a void, you should see much less. These two sets of panels are just little snippets of the Lyman Alpha forest through a real volume, sorted by galaxy overdensity in the surrounding cube. And so these are the highest galaxy overdensities on sort of 10 megaparsec cube scales surrounding a skewer that goes through the middle. And you can see that they've got fairly busy Lyman alpha forest spectra, where you have a lot of absorption, meaning a lot of H1. Down here are the largest galaxy voids in the sample. In other words, taking cubes that have few or no galaxies in the same kind of volume and looking at what the Lyman alpha forest looks like when you go through there. And you can see that qualitatively, one's naive expectations that there's more absorption in dense regions than there are in not so dense regions seems to be correct. What about quantitatively? Well, it turns out that, well, this is a plot of the expectation value of the galaxy density given how much absorption there is averaged over that skewer that goes through that cube in the Lyman alpha forest. In other words, it's just saying, to what extent is the overdensity of galaxies correlated with the overdensity of H1 absorption? And you can see it's a pretty strong correlation. And if you draw a line through zero here, you see that the expectation value of the galaxy overdensity goes through zero just in the place that corresponds to the average amount of absorption in the Lyman alpha forest at a redshift of 3. And so it follows both the voids and the dense regions in being correlated with one another. So that's good. It means that checks out. You know, the Lyman alpha forest seems to be tracing matter fluctuations. But it gets a little weird when you look at how this correlation coefficient between these two quantities varies as a function of how long the skewer length is through your cube. In other words, it's just looking at everything from a single pixel in the Lyman alpha forest and its ability to predict the galaxy overdensity in the entire surrounding 10 megaparsec cube, and going all the way out to a skewer that goes through the whole cube, and how and to what extent you would be able to make a prediction about galaxy density on that 10 megaparsec cube by looking at what's happening in the one-dimensional transmission function of the Lyman alpha forest. Now, all that may not make sense while you're just sitting here listening to it, but let me just say that this is what you actually expect that to be under the best possible circumstances, which is where both are linearly biased in some way with respect to the underlying dark matter distribution, and you have a standard lambda CDM type power spectrum. You expect a correlation coefficient that goes like this. And you can see that the observed correlation coefficient is about 2 sigma stronger than the happiest circumstances you could hope for in the model. So that's a little funny. Why might that be? How is it that the Lyman alpha forest knows more than it has any right to about how many galaxies there are in the volume? Well, you can mess with the you can mess with the shape of the power spectrum to get that correlation to be stronger. Maybe the power spectrum given by lambda CDM is not quite right. That's one way to do it. Another way is to actually mess with the temperature in the Lyman alpha forest to change the effective smoothing scale of a given pixel, or to make more correlated individual adjacent pixels in the Lyman alpha forest. This actually violates a lot of the consistency with the Lyman alpha forest observations. But what if it's something more mundane? What if it's just that the presence of galaxies does something to the intergalactic medium that perturbs it from it, what you would expect if it were just a quiescent medium following the dark matter distribution. And this, I think, illustrates this more, that point more powerfully. So I forgot to put in the latest version of this, but I can still explain this, I think. So imagine that you sit on every galaxy in that volume, and then you look at that skewer corresponding to the Lyman Alpha Forest going through the middle of your volume, and you just average the flux in the Lyman Alpha Forest as a function of distance from you. So you sit on every galaxy, and then you average all of those together. When you're far away from the line of sight, you more or less converge. And one of the things that happens in the new version of this is that these actually correspond to one another. This is you converge toward the average flux in the Lyman Alpha Forest, which is a residual flux of about 0.68. In other words, the average pixel is absorbed by 32% down from the top of the continuum. And then when you get closer into a galaxy, just as you expect if they're tracing matter fluctuations in the same way that galaxies are, you get stronger absorption as you come in. But then what happens is that you completely reverse that whole trend on scales less than one co-moving megaparsec. In other words, instead of having continually increasing absorption as you get closer and closer to a galaxy, you have almost none when you get to very small distances from the galaxies. And we're calling this the galaxy proximity effect, in the sense that H1 is depleted nearest to the galaxies.
So zero here means that you go right through.
Yeah, no, yes, exactly, right. Well, not quite right through. I mean, we actually don't have any measurements at zero. We have measurements at, 30 or 40 co-moving kiloparsecs is the smallest it gets to be. So these are our data, and this is what you expect in simulations. And you can see that what you actually expect is quite different. You expect the absorption to increase continually until you get closer and closer to the galaxy, until it's completely absorbed. And so you can see that the strength of this effect is actually much stronger than it appears in the last figure, because what really the theorists predict would happen is that you would be down here somewhere. And what this says is that there's not enough feedback in the simulations. And it's actually, you have to add an enormous amount to perturb things that much. This is just a two-dimensional view of sitting on a galaxy and looking at a picture of the average Lyman Alpha Forest surrounding you. And this is a region that has excess H1, and this is the region that's depleted in H1, very close to you.
Am I supposed to think of this as a giant Strongren sphere?
You can. It's not quite a Strongren sphere because it's not photoionization. You can show quite easily that you can't do it with photoionization. It has to be stuff that's heated by something, some other process. What about metals? Metals are an even more tangible clue, I think, because we know they had to come from galaxies. So if we look at where they are relative to where the galaxies we see are, that tells us a lot. This is a plot, if I direct your attention to the lower one, where we've collapsed everything down into one dimension. So we're just looking at the one-dimensional galaxy histogram in the surrounding volume around this skewer through the intergalactic medium. And if you bin up the galaxy overdensities as a function of redshift and do the same thing for the metal lines that you see, you can see that peaks and valleys in where the galaxies are correspond very, very closely to where the metals are. And you can this is a nice sort of qualitative view, and you can quantify that by just looking at the autocorrelation function of galaxies versus the cross-correlation between galaxies and metal systems observed along that, metal lines observed along that line of sight. And you can see that they're the same. They're the same correlation function. And that tells you, more or less, the galaxies and the metals as traced by carbon-4 are in the same parts of the intergalactic, or in the same parts of the universe. It's not very surprising, really, when you think about it, but it suggests that the universe is not at all homogeneously enriched. It's only enriched where galaxies are. And you're led, you can be led, this is another way, I mean, let me back up for a second and say, the actual observations for metals in the Lyman Alpha Forest are that anything that has an H1 column density larger than 3 times 10 to the 14 inverse centimeters squared has detectable metals. So what I'm saying is, if you have that high an H1 column density, you're pretty damn likely to be close to a galaxy.
So is that, I mean, that earlier in the talk you could argue that some people claimed it was uniform.
Yeah.
So this argues
the opposite. Yeah. Now, if you look in more detail as a function of how much carbon-4 there is in one of these systems, this is just taking a marginal, just saying inside, suppose we take a little volume that's the volume that we expect to be affected by the wind from a single galaxy, and we ask the question, So I take the galaxy-galaxy autocorrelation function evaluated on a particular scale versus the cross-correlation of the galaxies and the carbon-4 systems. And what happens is that when you go to carbon-4 column densities larger than 10 to the 13, the cross-correlation is stronger than the galaxy-galaxy autocorrelation. So what that tells you is that once you cross this threshold, you're more or less talking about one and the same object. The thing that's producing the metal lines is exactly the same as the thing that you're seeing as a galaxy, even though the typical separation is 100 to 200 kiloparsecs. So, you know, for a long time in quasar absorption line field, we always had this sort of dartboard picture of galaxies, where as you went to higher and higher ionization species, you needed to make your dartboard bigger in order to explain the observed cross-section. And this sort of gives some credence to that silly picture, simply based on cross-section arguments. But you can see that at lower, for the very weakest systems, which actually dominate that last plot that I showed, they're not directly correlated with the galaxies that we're observing, but they're definitely in the same general vicinity. And so you can see that there's a line where you go from being things that are attached to the very galaxy you're seeing to being just in the same general environment. This one's a little bit hard to explain, but essentially what it looks at the converse question, which is what fraction of all the metals that we see are within spitting distance of one of these Lyman break galaxies, so that the metals could have been put there by the very galaxy that we're looking at. And by the time you get to large carbon-4 column densities, it's a very high percentage. So what this tells us is that a lot of the metals that we see in the Lyman Alpha Forest at redshift 3 are coming from galaxies that are there forming stars at redshift 3. So this is more evidence for the sort of large-scale influence of the galaxies on the intergalactic medium. As we've already said, it really does suggest that the medium is inhomogeneously enriched. And, you know, it may be that a lot of the carbon-4 got there at a redshift of 10 when the first stars turned on in 10 to the 8th solar mass galaxies, but those are exactly the same places that are later going to contain a lot of these 10 to the 12 solar mass galaxies. That's just the way hierarchical structure formation works. These winds do a lot of other things for you. They get metals into the intracluster medium. Remember, these are future cluster galaxies, a lot of them. So this is exactly where the intracluster medium is getting preheated and blown out into. Most of the clusters are not collapsed. They're not virialized at this redshift, but the gas is heated before the system virializes by this feedback. You suppress star formation for quite a while once you blow all this gas, once you blow this bubble out to a couple hundred kiloparsecs. No stars are going to form anywhere in there for another couple of gigayears. And when the gas comes back in, it's going to come back in a lot more quiescently than it went out. So one idea is that you actually make disks with the gas when it finally comes back in again that was blown out. So in other words, the disks are formed from stuff that used to be in the compact inner regions. The bottom line is that the existence of these winds isn't all that surprising. Their strength is surprising, and especially the suggestion that it's big galaxies that are actually having a strong influence. the intergalactic medium, and not the small dwarf galaxies that have usually been the things that people assumed were perturbing things. And for the purposes of this audience, I would say that we're in the middle of writing a paper on what the implications are for actual cosmological use of the Lyman Alpha Forest, which is an interesting question. It's not easy to answer. It turns out that what you find out when you look into it in a lot of detail is that you can get something that looks like the sort of what you expected the power spectrum to look like almost any way, and that you can have all sorts of crazy things happening and you get something that looks about right. It doesn't mean you've got it right. It just means that it's not a very sensitive tool at the moment. Some uses of the Lyman Alpha Forest could be compromised. In particular, one of the things that goes away completely, I think, is the ability to estimate the baryon density by looking at the mean Lyman Alpha Forest transmissivity coupled with a measurement of the ionizing radiation field. And the reason is you've decoupled the correlation between baryon density and hydrogen between H1 density and baryon density in just the most dense regions. And so you've basically eliminated this fluctuating Gunn-Peterson approximation in just the places that contain most of the mass. And so relationships that are based on average properties of the Lyman Alpha Forest are extrapolating into those regions with no information are probably not going to get it quite right. So it does this messing up of, I mean, you can. Some people have started putting this information, these kinds of winds, into simulations, and you really see a huge difference in the appearance of a universe where winds are important compared to one where winds are not important. But when you measure the actual power spectrum, the power spectrum given by the transmissivity of the Lyman Alpha Forest doesn't actually change that significantly. So you might say, well, that's good. We don't care that galaxies are there wreaking havoc. But I think what it really says is that right now, the way that you get those numbers from the Lyman Alpha Forest, it's a little bit iffy, I think. And we'll have more to say about that pretty soon. Metals are where the galaxies are. And the real interesting thing from an astronomer's point of view is that you actually learn about how one of the aspects of galaxy formation that we don't understand at all, which is this sort of large-scale importance of feedback, by using the intergalactic medium, which is something that we can measure very well, and it will only improve in the future, you could actually make real tomographic maps of this diffuse medium if you had a next-generation telescope that could go another couple of magnitudes deeper to look at fainter background sources to probe this medium. And that's one of the big, it's one of the big scientific drivers for 30-meter class ground-based telescopes. And thanks, I'll stop there.
Yes? So I'm curious if this might have an effect on something that I've been very interested in, the deuterium abundance derived from the Lyman Alpha Forest, but in particular from the damp Lyman Alpha systems.
Right.
Those are the highest hydrogen column density. So if I understood what you were saying, I might expect those are the ones that are most correlated with the galaxy and with recent stellar evolution.
Yeah, well, I actually that's not true. I didn't show this, but we actually did an experiment where we cross-correlated damp Lyman Alpha systems in the quasar spectra with Lyman break galaxies in the surrounding volume. And it actually turns out that the things that you pick up as damp Lyman Alpha systems in quasar spectra are not in the same environments as these galaxies. They're much less strongly clustered. So they remember that you're picking up things that are cross-section weighted, and so they might not be able to survive in the kind of environment that that I'm talking about. And there are a lot of people who actually think damp Lyman Alpha systems are things that have gotten away with being the way they are because they're in the middle of nowhere.
So they don't contribute, say, the carbon-4?
No. Well, some small percentage of the carbon-4 comes from very high column density systems, but most of the carbon-4 comes from systems that are 10 to the 14 or 10 to the 15 in H1 column density. But it's a good question. I mean, you're concerned whether a lot of pro.
Is there any good evolution?
Yeah.
I mean, normally you say, well, metallicity is a fraction of solar,
right.
So there hasn't been much effect on the material, but maybe that's.
So the metallicities in the things that I'm talking about in the galaxies themselves are probably 10 times higher than in typical damp Lyman alpha systems at the same redshift.
So it would be interesting. Is it possible to see if you could find deuterium in any of those? Because that's where maybe.
No, I mean, the problem is that the velocity fields are. Of the outflowing stuff. We've measured metal abundances from the outflow material by using the same techniques you use for damp Lyman alpha systems, but the problem is that the metal lines are hundreds of kilometers per second wide, and that more or less wipes out the deuterium signature. Any other questions? Crystal.
So did you want to say anything about the small fraction of galaxies with the AGN activity? Can that be put in the context of the
Yeah, I think, you know, we can't discriminate between winds that are, we can't discriminate between environmental influences on large scales that come from AGN activity and those, you know, where you've converted AGN energy into mechanical energy. We can't discriminate between that and star formation. We can only say that we see evidence that star formation is pushing out a lot of gas. But we have to make a pretty big jump to go from the few kiloparsec scales where we actually see that gas coming out to the influence out at 150 kiloparsecs. And that could be leftover effects of AGN that lasted a lot less time than the stars but produced possibly more energy. I don't think we can say one way or the other. I mean, there's a lot of interest, I know, in the AGN field about, you know, wreaking havoc with AGN-produced winds and things like that. I don't think we can say one way or the other which it is. Not with confidence anyway. Anything else? Yes.
Since you have some idea of how much mechanical energy is required to drive all this gas out at the speeds you're seeing, can you make some connection with how many UV photons you would expect to accompany?
Yeah, well, we've tried to measure that directly. I might even have a slide. Oh, I should have said that this is what we're doing now. we're finding fields with many, many probes of the through the same volume, and this is, and by moving down to slightly lower redshifts, you get a lot more choices about quasars, and you can also find your own quite easily. And now we have things where we're doing tomography essentially through the intergalactic medium. And this is the distribution of galaxies with spectroscopic redshifts in that particular field. I have this. Somewhere, I think I have, yeah. So what we've tried to do is actually measure Lyman continuum radiation coming out of spectroscopically from the galaxies. It's a really hard measurement to make. And, you know, it involves detecting, you know, very small amounts of residual flux. Because what happens is ionizing photons don't have a very large mean free path even once they get out of a galaxy. And so it's a measurement that can only be made spectroscopically, because you actually expect any 9-12 angstrom photon to only make it about this far before it gets eaten up by something we know isn't the intergalactic medium. But you more or less quasars that we know about can't keep everything ionized at redshifts of 3. You have to have a contribution from something else. And in fact, I think the quasar contribution has been overestimated by a fairly large factor. It's been a wild extrapolation on what we know about the quasar luminosity function. So I think galaxies are very important to keeping the universe ionized. Number of ionizing photons, it's easy to calculate how many are produced in the galaxy. It's harder to calculate how many make it out. Anything else?
So if this fluctuating approximation is not valid, why do we expect the power spectrum still looks
Well, proponents of that technique would say it's because the power spectrum is a volume averaged statistic, whereas, and if you actually ask what fraction of the universe is affected by galaxy winds, if we just take the galaxies we actually see, which is the tip of the iceberg, and we calculate, and each one had a little 1 megaparsec thing, evacuated area around it, it would only be 2 or 3% of all the volume. The problem is that it does a lot of bad things to the Lyman Alpha forest. It makes things move around with non-gravitationally induced velocities. So you get weird things happening along a line of sight. For example, you can have a pixel that contains lots of mass but no H1, or you can have a pixel that contains not very much mass, but it happened to be a place where H1 piled up in front of a shock front, or behind a shock front, and was the first thing to cool. The net effect of the winds is actually to make more neutral hydrogen. And that's why we think it introduces these large-scale over-correlations, is because you get rid of neutral hydrogen on the 1 megaparsec scales, but you make denser gas outside of that range that cools a lot faster once the source of that energy in the center of the galaxy turns off. And so the net effect is to make more neutral hydrogen. So you mess up that correspondence, but if you're doing a volume averaged statistic, it might be relatively insensitive to that. It's not easy to answer your question. That's why I haven't. It turns out that you can do all sorts of crazy things to the Lyman Alpha forest and still make a power spectrum that looks just like the one that comes out when you don't put any physics in at all. So either that means that it's totally robust, or it means that it's not really telling you anything. Not sure which. Anything else?
More questions? No, let's thank Chuck again.